Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone requires assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Treatment Update on Colorectal Cancer. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have over 770 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States, and we have international participants from Egypt, Lebanon, the Philippines, Turkey, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, and it's a bit of a global call, actually, and we really appreciate your taking this time to be with us on the call today. Now, today's program was supported by a grant from Genentech and Taiho Oncology, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of this program and also for their collaborative partnership in making this program possible. And we have wonderful speakers today. I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Al Benson III, and Dr. Benson is Professor of Medicine, Associate Director for Cooperative Groups, Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center of Northwestern University. And Dr. Benson is going to present an overview of colorectal cancer. He's going to address treatment for metastatic and refractory colorectal cancer, novel treatment approaches, and predicting response to treatment, the role of precision medicine. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Benson.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and thanks to all of you for joining today to hear some of my comments about colorectal cancer. Colorectal cancer remains an incredibly important disease worldwide and is the third most common cancer. So this represents a significant health problem. The good news is that we've made substantial progress in screening and treatment of colorectal cancer, especially over the last 10 years. And this also represents a wonderful example of how patient participation in clinical trials has led to real innovation and new treatments. And you're going to hear a little bit more from Dr. Sirsak about clinical trials. Now, one important observation is that the incidence of colorectal cancer appears to be decreasing in older individuals, and typically colorectal cancer has been a disease of older individuals, and it's thought that this is because there have been many more patients who've undergone screening with colonoscopy, for example, and therefore we're identifying patients at earlier stages when the ability to cure a person is greatest. There also have been innovations in surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy, as well as biological therapies that have had an impact. Unfortunately, however, the incidence of colorectal cancer is increasing in younger individuals, younger than age 50. And we haven't totally figured out why this is so. Is it because of diet or environmental factors? It's not just people with inherited colorectal cancer. And individuals with inherited colorectal cancer, which represents maybe about 6% of the colorectal cancer population, is an important group, and it does, colon cancer can occur in younger individuals, but the inherited type of colon cancer is not the full explanation for this rising incidence in younger people. And we're going to have to figure this out. It also may affect how we screen patients for colorectal cancer. And I think one important message, if a younger person has symptoms, including rectal bleeding, these symptoms should not be ignored. Now, currently, there are 11 cancer drugs to treat colorectal cancer, two of which were recently approved by the FDA. One of these agents is a new chemotherapy drug called LONSURF, also known as TAS-102. And this is a combination drug of trifluridine and tipiracil. It is a pill, and its indication is for patients who have metastatic colorectal cancer and have received all other standard therapies, including combination therapies, but still have disease progression. And recent clinical trials have shown that this particular drug can provide added benefit. So this is another opportunity for treatment and has expanded what we refer to as the continuum of care. The continuum of care applies to patients with metastatic colorectal cancer, and the implication is that if patients are able to receive all of these standard drugs over time in sequence during the course of their disease, they have the best opportunity to benefit, to certainly live longer and be able to participate in important activities such as going to work and caring for family members. Now, another drug that was approved is not a chemotherapy drug, but referred to as a biologic agent. The biologic agents are most typically given together with chemotherapy drugs, and there are two basic classes of biological drugs we use in colorectal cancer, and these drugs are for people who have metastatic disease. Keep in mind that in terms of the newly diagnosed individuals we see each year with colorectal cancer, the majority do not have stage 4 disease. So the majority are able to undergo successful surgery. But about a quarter of people will present with metastatic disease. And then we have other individuals who have undergone successful surgery, but over time have developed disease progression. And this has been an area of research, and the clinical trials in this arena have tried to address a very important need for these individuals and have led to the development of these 11 drugs I mentioned. One of the biological areas is referred to as angiogenesis. And this is the process of new blood vessel formation, which is essential for tumors to be able to grow. And so tackling angiogenesis has been a target for therapy. And we now have three different agents that we combine with chemotherapy that can do this. Through clinical trials, it's been shown that this type of intervention does work, and people have enjoyed longer overall survival with these combinations of angiogenesis drugs. The most commonly used is referred to as bevacizumab, also known as Avastin, but there's also the drugs of aflibercept, as well as ramucirumab, that can be combined with chemotherapy drugs. And the typical chemotherapy drugs where these anti-angiogenesis agents are combined include the drugs oxaliplatin, irinotecan, and 5-FU, or an oral type of 5-FU known as capecitabine. The second biological group refers to a particular genetic mutation that we can identify within a tumor. And you're going to hear more about targeted therapy, but this is an example where we evaluate tumors from patients with metastatic colorectal cancer to see if they have what's known as a RAS mutation. Our understanding of RAS has progressed over the years. It's an important development, and it is a critical development because if an individual has a RAS mutation, and it's estimated that somewhere between 50 and 60% of individuals will have a RAS mutation, then they will not benefit from the two biological drugs known as panitumumab and cetuximab. So when a person is diagnosed with metastatic disease, it's important to test the tumor for RAS mutation status because it can influence future treatment planning. Now, one big area that's generated a great deal of excitement is what's known as immuno-oncology. Immuno-oncology is not a new concept, but it's only been more recent times when we've accelerated our understanding of the immune system and have been able to develop drugs which have been recently approved by the FDA for treatment of some cancers. Now, in colon cancer, there has been a significant challenge in that the majority of people with colon cancer do not appear to have immunosensitive type tumors. And one of our great challenges in research currently is to how to make the majority of colon cancers more responsive to immunologic interventions. Now, there is a subgroup of individuals. It only represents about 4% of all people with metastatic colorectal cancer who have what's known as microsatellite instability. These tumors tend to have very, very large numbers of mutations. And if a tumor has large numbers of mutations, they're more likely to benefit from immunotherapy. And early clinical trials indeed have demonstrated that individuals with MSI-positive tumors can respond to immunotherapy. And therefore, there are a series of clinical trials further investigating this concept, which we hope will lead to FDA approval for use of these types of drugs for at least select people with metastatic colorectal cancer. There are other areas, other types of mutations and genetic changes within tumors that are potential targets for therapeutic intervention, and these are being studied currently. And this is the area of what we refer to as personalized medicine or precision medicine. As mentioned, we have some what we call tumor markers that can help us, one being RAS mutation, one being MSI. But the challenge is to identify other markers that will enable us to select patients for more precise treatment intervention so that we're really tackling the biological pathways or genomic changes within a tumor that we hope will make a real difference in the long run. So in conclusion, we've made lots of progress. We've developed new drugs. New drugs are still being developed. And overall, this has led to much better outcomes for our patients, and this work continues. So thank you for your attention.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Benson. That was outstanding and really identified a lot of the issues in terms of colorectal cancer. And I know there will be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. Really excellent and very comprehensive. And our next speaker is Dr. Andrea Sercek. Dr. Sercek is an assistant attending physician, gastrointestinal oncology service, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Sercek is going to address targeted cancer therapies, clinical trials, side effects, symptom, and pain management, and communicating with your healthcare team, a very essential issues for all of you to be to learn more about. I'm delighted to now turn this program over to Dr. Sirsak.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mesner, for the introduction and the invitation to be here, and thank you, everyone in the audience for participating today. So I'll start the discussion with targeted treatments for colorectal cancer, and specifically for metastatic colorectal cancer. Targeted treatments, as Dr. Benson described, focus on specific cell mechanisms which are thought to be important for the growth and survival of tumor cells. So they work in different ways to destroy cancer cells. Some of the agents target the blood vessels, which were reviewed by Dr. Benson, such as bevacizumab, aflibercept, and to an extent also Stivarga or regorafenib. Other agents, which are really what we describe as the targeted treatments, are cetuximab and panitumumab. And these block certain kinds of receptors that actually act as a sort of small lock and key, if you will, sort of antennas on the surface of colorectal cancer cells. And what they do is when they're activated, they signal to other genes downstream to give the cell a signal to grow and multiply. So by blocking these receptors, the drugs, cetuximab and panitumumab, prevent growth factors from telling the cell to turn on and to divide. And they are part of a class of drugs known as EGFR inhibitors or epidermal growth factor inhibitors because they block the epidermal growth factor. Stivarga is also considered a targeted agent, although this is somewhat of a mixed target in that it targets a number of receptors that we think are important in the signaling process. So it's very important to personalize treatment with targeted agents, and we have learned, and Dr. Benson reviewed this very nicely as well, that certain mutations in the pathway of this receptor prevent the drugs from working, and that's what's called KRAS. So each tumor, each individual tumor has its own biological makeup based on the genes that are found in its cells. And what we're really trying to find out is what is the biology of tumors, what is the biology of the tumor's genes, and how some tumors respond to treatment and others don't, and why treatment in some patients works well, in others it doesn't. And we think a lot of this has to do with the biological makeup of the individual person's cancer cells and, in some part, the signaling pathway. So what we look for to better understand the type of tumor that each patient has, we look for markers in the cell's genes. And some of this is what we call personalized medicine, where we really look at the genes and say, what is the signature of this tumor? Because we know that some changes, or what we call mutations, can predict whether or not a treatment will work. And this is really important with cetuximab and panitumumab, the anti-EGFR drugs, because about half, 50 to 60% of patients with metastatic colorectal cancer have a mutation in the RAS gene. And what this means is that when we give the drugs, cetuximab or panitumumab, the patients have the side effects of the drugs but don't have any response at all. So it's only about half to 40% of our patients that actually do not have this mutation or are what we call RAS wild type that can then receive these drugs. And so that's a critical point, and the majority of patients, when they are first diagnosed, undergo this testing, whether it's a large panel of genes or at least a limited panel of 8 to 13 genes to say, okay, either the patient does have a mutation in KRAS or does not have a mutation, so that we can then decide whether or not they are eligible for anti-EGFR therapy. So it is very, very important. The way we arrived at this was through clinical trials, through studies, evaluating patients who responded and those who didn't, and then looking back at their tumors, looking back at the biological makeup, and seeing that about half of the patients who received the drug had the side effects but no benefit. So this is a really, really critical point in terms of deciding not only for anti-EGFR therapy but also for novel therapies. And just to give a bit more detail, in the patients that do not have the RAS mutation, so for RAS wild-type patients, we can use these drugs, cetuximab and panitumumab, anywhere from right when they are first diagnosed, or what we call first-line therapy with combination with chemotherapy, such as FOLFIRI or FOLFOX, or in second line once the tumor has learned to grow on the first chemotherapy, or even later on when the tumor has grown on two chemotherapies, these drugs in combination or alone still can't work. But again, importantly, it's only in about half of our patients. Another important marker that we have learned is BRAF, and patients with BRAF tumors also for the majority do not respond to cetuximab and panitumumab that block the EGFR receptor. So this is another gene that is downstream in this pathway that if there is a mutation just turns the signal on, and no matter if we give the drug cetuximab or panitumumab, the signal is not turned off and the cell is constantly replicating and dividing, and the patients are exposed to toxicity and don't benefit. Through clinical trials, though, we have learned that there are certain drugs that are able to block this change, this gene BRAF, and in combination get a response that we see otherwise in patients who don't have the RAF mutation. That has still not been approved by the FDA, but it's a very active and exciting area of research. And importantly, clinical trials is really the way that we have arrived at all of our therapies, as Dr. Benson mentioned, from the very beginning with just our 5-FU to combination chemotherapies with oxaliplatin and irinotecan, and now in the modern era with targeted agents and mutational analyses such as anti-EGFR therapy. It's really been studied and learned about and established through clinical trials. And what is a clinical trial? A clinical trial is a research study that uses patients, patients enroll, to find new ways to improve treatment. And there are different phases of clinical trials. The majority of clinical trials are phase one, where we are learning for the first time, where we are studying a drug in people for the first time. We learned that there was a signal either in animal studies or in cell culture, and now we're testing on people to see if it really does work in a particular disease or a particular subset of diseases. So we know the drug, we don't know what dose is safe, and we don't know what the side effects are. In phase two, we have a sense of what we know what dose is safe. We are trying to see, does it really work as well as we thought? In phase one, we usually get a little bit of a signal, and then we say, let's try this in phase two, where we have a dose. Let's try it in a larger group of patients to see if it works. And in phase three, what we do is we take the drug that has shown activity in phase two, and now we study it compared to another type of treatment. And so this way we learn about the side effects, we learn about the efficacy, we see if the drug is in fact better, the same or worse than an established drug. So these are all very important phases of clinical trials, and again, it's an important and active area of research. And in colorectal cancer in particular, recently an exciting area of research with personalized medicine, looking at the genetic makeup of tumors, targeting certain changes that may not have been known to be only in colorectal cancer, but for which we may have drugs in other diseases to see, well, perhaps this is the change, this is the gene or mutation that might be causing this colon cancer cell to live and survive, and so we can try a particular inhibitor on that cell, on that patient, as well as in immunotherapy, as Dr. Benson described, a small subset of patients at the moment are known to be responsive to immunotherapy, and those are patients whose tumors have many, many mutations, but we are actively working on trying to stimulate the immune system, even in the large majority of colorectal cancer patients with metastatic disease that don't have a lot of mutations, to say, well, somehow we might be able to make the immune system recognize the cancer cell and then give immunotherapy to really stimulate that response and try to destroy the cancer cells. So clinical trials are critical. The majority of patients are eligible for clinical trials if they are physically fit and have been exposed to a few chemotherapies. But this is very much dependent on the individual, and I would highly recommend discussing this with your individual physicians in terms of which clinical trials may be available and which clinical trials would be a good option. Importantly for the treatment of colorectal cancer or any cancer is management of side effects. Side effects are obviously an associated component of treatment, but can be managed quite well to the point that they are a minor inconvenience and don't really dictate patients' lives. So we try very much to prevent side effects as much as possible. We try to treat them promptly if they do develop. And I always tell my patients there is no such thing as a silly question. If there's something concerning, something bothering you, I would rather know about it than not know, because if there is a chance that we can intervene early, we can really make a big difference. And a big example of that is nausea and vomiting. The majority of our chemotherapies, unfortunately, do cause nausea and vomiting. However, we have excellent anti-nausea medications where if taken early, before the nausea and the vomiting really ensues, they can really stop the process and patients can tolerate treatment much better. Other issues are infections. We do worry about infections because chemotherapies, the majority of them can lower the white blood cells, which are infection-fighting cells. Fevers are a big deal. We want to know if anyone has a low-grade fever so that we might have them examined to make sure that their blood counts are in fact with normal, and if they are low, we might give antibiotics. We will investigate to see if there's an infection, or we might be able to preventively give growth factor support to prevent infections from happening if we see that in fact a patient is developing low white blood cells from chemotherapy. Likewise, anemia, the chemotherapy affects all cells that are quickly dividing. Our white cells are one of those cells. Our red cells are such cells as well, so patients can be anemic, they can have fatigue. So we often monitor that very closely. If patients do feel fatigue, we want to know about it. We might check for anemia, and we can supplement that with iron or just with food depending on the levels. So it's really important to speak to your doctors about that. Blood clots can happen. They can be serious and life-threatening. So if there is swelling of the legs, particularly if one leg is more swollen than another, we would definitely want to know about that and investigate it further. Another issue with chemotherapy is that it can cause thinning of the lining of the mouth as well as the intestinal lining. So the mouth thinning is called mucositis, or it can almost be like sores, such as canker sores, or they look like canker sores. That's something we definitely want to know about, specifically if a patient is having trouble eating between seeing us because of such severe mouth sores. We can always adjust the dose or give supportive treatment, mouthwashes, et cetera, to manage that better. An important side effect of our targeted agents, the cetuximab and panitumumab I described earlier, is a skin rash. And this is not a trivial side effect. It can be obvious. It can look like an acne-type rash, almost like teenage pimples, but the skin is very, very dry and irritated. We can often try to prevent them with antibiotics or certain creams, so that is absolutely something to speak with your physician about as well, as we can do our best to treat it. The rash does tend to subside after a couple of months, but it can be something that affects the patient's quality of life, so I always make sure that I discuss that very clearly with my patients. And importantly also is neuropathy, which is nerve damage from one of our drugs, oxaliplatin, which is a very common drug that we use in both stage 4 as well as stage 3 and some stage 2 diseases. And that is almost like a numbness and tingling that happens in the hands and feet. There is a type that is transient that happens right after treatment that is only cold, but that affects the throat as well. That's usually manageable. Patients keep their food at lukewarm temperature, maybe keep a pair of gloves by the refrigerator before reaching into the refrigerator, but that goes away. There is a second kind that can happen over time. And it's a bit of a sneaky drug because it can start even after the drug is discontinued. So if you do notice any of that, it's really important to share those symptoms with your oncologist as well. And of course, pain can affect people's quality of life. It can make you not want to go out. It can make you not want to eat, which in turn can lead to dehydration and just really have a number of very bad side effects. And we do have excellent pain medications that we can help manage. We can help manage the side effects of pain medications. So people are often concerned, will I become addicted? I don't want to take this. I would rather just deal with it. I always tell my patients that that's absolutely not the right approach, that we can, that cancer pain is real pain. We have good medications for it. We can help with the side effects such as constipation, and that is not something that they should be suffering with unnecessarily. So most important, I think, the take-home point of the discussion of side effects is that communication with your physicians, with your nurses taking care of you, is of utmost importance. And I believe that with good communication, we can really improve treatment-related side effects and improve quality of life on chemotherapy. And thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Sisek. That was incredibly comprehensive, and thank you so much. Very clear and really covering a lot of different topics that I know there will be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you very much. And our next speaker is Diana Bearden, and Ms. Bearden is a dietitian. She's supervised at Clinical Nutrition, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Ms. Bearden is going to address nutrition and hydration concerns and tips. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Bearden.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm excited to talk today because I've worked with GI patients for quite some time, so I have a fondness for this particular topic. So just to start with, most treatments for colorectal cancer, have it be from surgery, radiation, or chemotherapy, can affect your eating and can impact your nutrition. The treatments can potentially increase your body's need for additional nutrition, but talking with your dietitian, she can help you with a personalized plan to meet those needs. Diet modifications may also be necessary during your treatment just based on the side effects you're experiencing. But the important thing is keeping your nutrition up. And what does that mean? It means maintaining your weight, getting in the calories and protein that your body needs in order to heal and to do your daily activities. So the impact through treatment when you're eating well can be pretty significant. We find that patients who eat well during their treatment, maintain their nutrition, have an improved tolerance to treatment. They also recover better, and there's less treatment delays, less issues with side effects and things that can reduce treatment plans. So working with your dietitian in that particular group can really make a difference in helping you know your individual needs and how to address your individual needs. So when we look at your diet, there are a few things that you may hear often, and calories is one of them, getting enough calories in. So calories provide us energy. They help us maintain our weight. They help promote healing after treatment. They can come from carbohydrates, fat, or protein. To help meet your calorie needs, one kind of easy way to do that is just breaking your meals up into small, frequent meals. A lot of times patients feel full, maybe bloated, maybe they just don't have a big appetite from the treatment, and small, frequent meals tend to be better tolerated. They don't also feel as overwhelmed when you're sitting down to eat. Sometimes the larger the meal in front of you, the little daunting that can feel. And so when we're looking at small frequent meals, we really want to focus on foods that are good calorie and good protein sources and can give you that quality in a small volume. So there are some products out there that can help fortify your food, but definitely talk with your healthcare team to make sure that these are appropriate for you to take during your treatment. Sometimes there can be interactions with some of the components within the supplement. Not all supplements are made the same. And so just review those with your healthcare team. But by getting enough calories in, our body then will not use our lean muscle mass for the energy it needs in order to heal and to function every day. So calories are very important in the big picture, but the quality of calories is the other aspect of it. And we want patients to really eat for the nutrition of the food. And so talking with your healthcare team, talking with your dietitian, she can help, she or he can help help you know which foods to focus on, those that you'll tolerate, and also give you the best nutrition. protein is also essential, and although calories overall are very important in how your body uses or pools energy, we need to make sure we're getting enough calories in per day. Protein is also very important, and protein is really the basic form that our cells need to help heal, to renew, and we want to keep our muscle mass where it is because that's going to impact our endurance. So we don't want to be fatigued. And so good protein sources that you can bring into your diet are things like eggs, other dairy products, meat, fish. Those are all good quality sources of protein. But again, there are some products out there and that, you know, there's whey protein, there's soy protein, there's a lot of flax. Just talk with your healthcare team about which is more appropriate for you, and then bringing in the actual container is helpful because looking at the ingredients is essential to examining the product. Adequate fluid is something we oftentimes forget about. You know, we focus a lot on, are you eating enough? Okay, you've lost some weight. But fluid is essential, and dehydration is very powerful, can really enhance your side effects. It can make you feel worse. It can, you know, make you feel nauseated. It can give you a dry mouth, oftentimes even affecting your taste. It can make you feel more fatigued, tired, dizzy. Fluids are anything that's liquid at room temperature. So this includes water, juice, sports drinks, soups, Jell-O, a whole list of different foods that you may not always assume would be considered a fluid. If you happen to have a reconstructive procedure, hydration may be a little bit more of a focus in your treatment plan. And there also may be some modifications to fiber. If, for example, you have an ileostomy or a colostomy, something like that, monitoring the output, the consistency of the output may be something your team discusses with you. And there are ways to help address that with your diet. So working with your wound ostomy nurse, your healthcare team, your dietitian, everyone, they can help give you the best guidance to do that. Something to remember, if you're having a lot of diarrhea or if you're having a lot of nausea and vomiting, there are electrolytes that we lose. Oftentimes, it's not on the radar for your average person who hasn't experienced something like this before and will drink water and drink a lot of water, but oftentimes you'll need to supplement with some additional electrolytes. And so this may be something that's discussed with you if it's you know, part of the need that's identified, but it's not abnormal, and it's just something that you may not have come across in your day-to-day life prior to experiencing this you know, disease treatment. So there are items out on the market that are accessible, and it's just knowing that that's a potential issue that may come up. Now, when we're going through treatment, you know, patients are, you're tired, you're overwhelmed, sometimes you're traveling, and you're just not in your regular program, and we can feel like, oh, I feel like I'm eating the same, I feel like I'm drinking the same that I normally would, but between resting, maybe you're taking naps more frequently throughout the day, maybe you just don't have the energy, or maybe you're just not that hungry, our perception of what is, you know, what you're eating can be skewed a bit. So when I have patients who are challenged or they're losing some weight, I'm always asking, okay, you know, the healthcare provider, the one at home, the healthcare giver, or even the patient, just to write down when you eat something. After you've completed it, write down how much you've eaten. And that just helps not only us whenever we're trying to, you know, give you suggestions and some feedback, but it also helps if you're having side effects. It lets us know, okay, what was going on? What did you eat? How long after did you experience maybe nausea or diarrhea, something like that? And it helps us help you better. So writing down what you're eating after you've eaten it is very helpful. The diet modifications may be necessary not only during treatment, potentially after treatment as well. So this might include avoiding some foods that would be addressing, you know, bowel function. Maybe you have sensitivities to particular foods you didn't have before. And so just recognizing those and modifying your diet long-term to help, with those side effects. Oftentimes, if you've had surgery, you might be doing some bowel management training again. And so nutrition comes into play with that, the types of foods that you focus on, maybe those to avoid. The immediate treatment side effects, so can range from, temperature sensitivity, mouth soreness, nausea and vomiting, changes in taste. Those are all very, very common, and everybody experiences them differently. And so just being in good communication with your team, telling them if foods are tasting too salty or too sweet or if you're having a metallic taste, that's very important in how they can help you. And another thing to take note of, a lot of times it isn't always discussed because there's so many other immediate things on the table, but if you're able to continue to exercise, if that's something you were doing before, based on what your physician allows you to do physically, that can also help with digestion. It can help with stress relief, and it can help with keeping your energy up in your muscle mass, intact so that your endurance continues. Big part of that is your impact of quality of life and being able to do your own daily activities. But remember, the main goal during your treatment is maintaining weight, keeping that lean muscle mass, eating for the nutrition of the food, and then modifying whatever that is based on what your side effects are. So, again, I know we've said this several times in this talk, but talking with your healthcare team is important. They won't know unless you tell them. And like I said, not everybody experiences the same thing. So we need to know from you what you're experiencing to best help you. So I'm going to turn this back to Carolyn. Thank you so much for allowing me to be part of this workshop today, and I'll pass it back to you, Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Diana. That was really wonderful. Just a very comprehensive perspective on really hydration and nutrition and how important it is. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Elizabeth Ezra. And Ms. Ezra is an oncology social worker. She's our program coordinator at Cancer Care. And Ms. Ezra will be addressing Cancer Care's free psychosocial programs and services and the role of support groups. It's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to my colleague and Elizabeth Ezra.
Thank you, Carolyn, and thank you all for listening to this great program. I hope we can continue to help each other. I am an oncology social worker, and I work with many people with colorectal cancer and their loved ones. I would like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. That help continues as you travel on the road of cancer, so don't forget that we're here to help you. And there are many ways that we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care programs include individual counseling, support groups, either over the telephone or online, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance as well. And all of this is provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. They are also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany that disease, such as the financial demands, the physical changes, social adjustment, and psychological impact and care. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. Asking for help by joining a support group or contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through a similar situation or have similar problems. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Support groups are a safe place where you can voice your concerns and your fears. Feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and the treatment. At this time, Cancer Care offers a colorectal cancer patient telephone support group, as well as one online. There is also an online general caregiver group as well. Cancer Care can provide some financial assistance for transportation expenses. If you are interested in any of these Cancer Care services, please call our HOPE line at 1-800-813-HOPE or 1-800-813-4673 or on our website at www.cancercare.org. Our website is very comprehensive, and you can find a lot of additional information about your cancer diagnosis and the treatment you need to receive. We have three PDF-style fact sheets on helping you talk to your doctor more effectively. One is called Doctor, Can We Talk? Tips for communicating with your healthcare team. One is When to Get a Second Opinion. And one is Questions to Ask Your Healthcare Team. So these will give you additional ideas of where to start the conversation and how to deepen that conversation as you go through this cancer treatment. So as we have learned today from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and get your arms around. Our social workers can help you understand what it means for you and your family. Your social worker can help you prioritize and actually rehearse the questions that you might want to ask to get the answers and the information that you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care Services are there to help you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk to you today.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Ezra. I think that was really wonderful and a really wonderful review of many of the services that people can access from Cancer Care for free, so that please do take advantage of that. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions, and I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board for the question period. And Stephanie will explain to you how to queue up for questions. And we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible, and if we don't get your questions, I will actually tell you all what to do in terms of getting your questions answered at the end of the call. So, Stephanie?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. If you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Rita R. Your line is open. Rita, your line is open. They may have pressed the star one key in error. Again, to ask a question, please press star then one at this time.
And we have a question from one of our online participants from Joan. Can you discuss more about TAS-102 in treating refractory colorectal cancer? Dr. Benson, could you say more about that?
Yes, so this is an oral drug. It's a chemotherapy drug. And it's not 5-FU. It's sometimes confused with 5-FU, but it is a class of drugs known as an anti-metabolite, and 5-FU is also an anti-metabolite. But the drug trifluridine is the active chemotherapy drug, but if you gave that drug alone, the body would rapidly degrade it. And so it's combined with a drug called tipiracil, which helps prevent rapid degradation. And so more drug is available to affect the tumor cell. So it is an oral chemotherapy drug. And the clinical trials that were conducted compared this drug versus placebo for individuals who had received all standard chemotherapy and combination drugs, so including drugs like cetuximab and bevacizumab. And there were people who clearly benefited who had stabilization of their disease. So this opens the door for yet another treatment for individuals. The drug you also heard about, regorafenib, is another oral drug. It's not a chemotherapy drug, but it is also for people who have progressed after standard therapy. So either regorafenib or Lonsurf can be used in that setting. It does have potential side effects. It can lower blood counts, for example, so people have to be monitored carefully as you would on any treatment.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you very much. And our next online question comes from Jim. I recently found out my colon cancer relapsed. Am I going to be treated with the same way as my initial diagnosis, or do doctors move on to a new treatment course for relapsed disease? Dr. Sirsak, could you address this in a general way, and then we would encourage Jim to go back to his treating healthcare team?
So that's a great question. One of the regimens that we use in metastatic and relapsed disease is the same as what we give preventatively in stage 3 disease, and that's called FOLFOX. So whether or not you receive the same regimen is a little bit dependent on when you last had chemotherapy. Generally, if the cancer relapses quickly after completing therapy for stage 3 disease, we don't use the same drugs. We move on to something different. If there has been a long time, then we might use that regimen again. And it depends also a little bit on the side effects. For example, the oxaliplatin and FOLFOX can cause neuropathy. So if you have neuropathy still from your preventative treatment that you received for stage 3 disease, then we may not reuse the same regimen. I hope that answers the question.
Excellent. Thank you. And another question from one of our online participants, from Janet. Why would my doctor recommend chemotherapy before surgery for resectable metastatic colorectal cancer? Dr. Benson, could you address that in a general way?
Yes. So there are individuals who develop metastatic disease. Typically, that would be the liver, but sometimes the lung also, who can actually have surgical removal. And this is an important area to determine and requires a multidisciplinary decision between the surgeon and the oncologist. But there are individuals where it may be uncertain whether the surgery should be done, and chemotherapy is given first, and we can actually see shrinkage that enables an easier surgery, for example. For people who are newly diagnosed and potentially a surgical candidate, we generally give chemotherapy first. We want to see if the tumor is chemosensitive and to make sure that the disease is not growing rapidly. So if we give 2 to 3 months of chemotherapy, we see shrinkage, no new disease, then we have more confidence that surgery would be an important step for that individual.
Thank you. And we have a question from another of our online participants, Marlon. So the question is, Dr. Benson mentioned that we are now seeing younger than 50-year-old patients with colorectal cancer, and it may be on account of diet. What are your thoughts on the possibility of diet causing colorectal cancer in younger patients? So it's really a question for, I guess, Dr. Benson and for Ms. Bearden as well. But Dr. Benson, do you want to start this one?
Well, as I emphasize, we don't really know what the exact reason is. There is a growing body of evidence that obesity, for example, and dietary factors can contribute to colon cancer, and we know that obesity is increasing, particularly in children. And whether this is a factor or not, we just don't know. But it's going to be an area that needs to be explored, because we certainly understand that environmental factors, including diet, can be important contributors to the development of cancer. So there'll be more and more work studying this question.
Excellent. And Ms. Baird, did you want to add anything? Or?
Yeah, what I wanted to say was we don't have anything concrete at this point, but what I would encourage is just to follow the prevention guidelines. And the American Institute for Cancer Research is a great website to check out. But, you know, they're encouraging us to be as lean as possible while maintaining good health, eating a plant-based diet where we have a variety of plant-based foods in our diet, including, you know, our whole grains, the least processed, the better, fruits and vegetables, beans, peas, and lentils, a variety of color on our plate, and then focusing on those lean protein sources, primarily, our fish, our poultry, white poultry, and then doing vegetarian meals sometimes with just beans as a good protein source or, whatever your preference might be to combine with that. Quinoa is a good complete protein. So we really want to look at reducing inflammation, providing the antioxidants, phytochemicals, being physically active. There's a physical activity recommendation of moderate activity a week of 150 minutes or vigorous of 75. They discuss alcohol consumption. If you don't drink, don't start. If you do, limiting it to no more than one drink a day for women, no more than two for men, and avoiding processed foods, especially processed meats as much as possible. So I think following those guidelines is what we have right now. And, as a whole, I feel like that's probably the best place to start right now. Excuse me.
Excellent. And we have one last breaking question here. So I'm a metastatic colorectal patient. It's from Gwendolyn, and I'm concerned about my children's risk. What screenings or testings are available to them? Is this something you would recommend? Dr. Sarasek, could you address this question in a general way? And, of course, we would recommend that Gwendolyn, of course, go to her own treating physician.
Yeah, so generally the recommendation for relatives or children of patients with colorectal cancer depends a bit on the age. The typical recommendation in the guidelines is 10 years younger to undergo a screening colonoscopy 10 years younger than the patient, so than the parent who has cancer, for example. That depends a little bit on whether or not there is any genetic predisposition, which would be something to discuss with your physician. We often test tumors for signs of hereditary colorectal cancer, such as Lynch syndrome. So if that were found to be the case, then your children would require screening sooner, not only with colonoscopy, but with also genetic screening. But if it's a sort of what we call average risk colorectal cancer in someone, let's say 60 years or older, then the recommendation is for screening colonoscopy 10 years younger than when you were diagnosed.
Thank you very much. And I want to thank all of our speakers. This has been a phenomenal call, I have to say. Our speakers have been outstanding. These have been outstanding questions from a lot of our online participants, really posing questions. And Rita, you'll probably call us afterwards and you can get through to us, so please do. And I want to let you all know this is a one-hour workshop, and then in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So I do want to remind all of you that although our workshop will soon end, the services that you can access from Cancer Care, those continue. And I think Liz has done quite an eloquent job in describing all the services that you can access from Cancer Care. They're all free, and they're all really supportive services, including practical and financial assistance. We also offer counseling services and support groups. And online support groups and telephone groups. And we also, of course, have these workshops. And we also have many publications that many of you may find, as Liz had mentioned, various fact sheets and publications as well. And we have many more programs coming up. I just want to remind you that we do have a program coming up on clinical trials. For those of you who are interested, you heard a lot about clinical trials today and how important they are. And that program is on Friday, May 20th. from 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time. And so for those of you who haven't signed up yet, please do, and many of you have already. And again, I want to thank you all for participating today. Now, if you have a question and didn't get to ask your question, and if it's a medical question, I would very much recommend that you call the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237. Again, 1-800-422-6237. And that would be a really wonderful resource for your cancer, any of your questions regarding your colorectal cancer or cancer in general. However, if you have a question in terms of services from cancer care, from our oncology social work staff, then I would have you call Cancer Care's number at 1-800-813-4673. Again, 1-800-813-4673. Again, I want to thank you for participating today. I, too, want to remind you all that you're not alone, that you're now part of the cancer care community, and that you can call us at any time. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect, and everyone have a wonderful day.